Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com. accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast. And today I'd like to start out by reminding you once again that there is an entire website behind this called wealthformula.com. And wealthformula.com has all sorts of interesting downloads, including a copy of my book, Seven Secrets of Eternal Wealth, which you can also simply download by texting me at 44222 and simply texting the word wealth formula, one word. Again, that's 44222 and put in wealth formula and you'll get that book. Now, the other things I want to remind you of is that if you go to wealthformula.com, you can also ask me a question or make some kind of a comment or a wisecrack, whatever you want. Go to SpeakPipe and just record it, and we'll use it on the next Ask Buck show. We've got a few waiting in line. We need some more. We need some. I want to get you involved with this, so make sure to go and go to wealthformula.com and make sure you go to that SpeakPipe function. It's super cool. And finally, don't forget, there's an entire course and there's a community behind this called the Wealth Formula Network. You can check all that out at wealthformularoadmap.com. The community in particular has been very, very interesting. We have biweekly calls, and now you can actually download the app. You don't have to be part of Wealth Formula Network to download the app, but I highly recommend you go ahead and do that anyway. Download the Wealth Formula app from your usual, whether it's iTunes, whatever, and that'll make it a lot easier to be more engaged with the show, especially if you're a part of Wealth Formula Network, because you'll be able to access the forum directly through there, and there'll be all sorts of fun stuff. So check that out. Now, let's talk today about our mindset in general. Well, not so much mindset as much as our the way we view the world. I mean, if you listen to my show, there's a good chance you listen to other shows with similar themes and opinions. I should say similar because it's mine's a little different, I think. Because in my niche, the one ongoing theme is that the zombie apocalypse is just around the corner. The zombie apocalypse is, of course, another financial meltdown reminiscent of 2008 or even worse. So if you've read Jim Rickard's The Road to Ruin, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And to be fair, it could be on its way. I'm not saying it's not. I don't know. The problem is that people started saying that almost as soon as the last recovery began. And a decade later, a lot of people have made a lot of money by not sitting on the sidelines. You know, and I have to admit, I've been guilty of this a little bit myself. And I'd be completely honest with you. I've felt pessimistic in the last couple of years. And in the meantime, you know, maybe I should have taken some, maybe I should have gotten into some things that I didn't. It's just hard. You can't really predict the future. I mean, I've been concerned about the economy for the last couple of years, and I still am. But we also have to understand, again, that we cannot predict the future. The next recession may very well happen next month, and it may happen in a couple of years. But even if it happens next month, it may not be that big deal at all. You know, it used to be that there was something called an economic cycle where things went up a little bit and down a little bit and the Fed could intervene. And, you know, most of our lives, we haven't, you know, noticed those things happening that dramatically, right? It's because they haven't. 2008 was an exception. So just recession does not necessarily mean zombie apocalypse, although it could. It could be that avalanche that Jim Rickards has been predicting for years. So what do you do, right? What do you do? Well, first, in my opinion, you've got to listen to people outside your own circles a little bit. This real asset investing community out there who listens to my show and to listen to other shows that are related, it's a good thing, but it can also be dangerous sometimes. It can sometimes create an echo chamber. You know, a small community is sometimes like living in an echo chamber where everyone seems to be saying the same thing. In fact, I remember that back in April of 2017 on the Real Estate Guys Summit at Sea, which I recommend highly, I'll be there next year in March, I met Robert Kiyosaki, and we were, you know, we'd watch a bunch of really interesting talks. And I asked him what he thought about all the speakers and what they were saying. And he told me, to my surprise a little bit, that he was a little bit worried. And when I asked him why, I had assumed that he, you know, just because the economy was going to tank or something like that, and he was worried about that. But no, that's not what he said. He said he was a little worried because everyone seemed to be agreeing with each other too much. He said, it makes me wonder what I'm missing. Now, that's an intelligent man, right? This is a real phenomenon that we all need to check ourselves on, including me. And it's because that as tribes, we tend to congregate around a core set of belief systems, which may become so pervasive that opinion or belief can be misconstrued as fact, as reality. In other words, make sure you listen to multiple sources to get your information. Listen to people with whom you disagree as well as with those you agree. And when you disagree, try to articulate why. Don't just be emotional about it. You know, people who have taken a Chicken Little approach to investing over the past 5 years, you know, they lost a lot of money by not making it. Like they look, you know, a lot of these people have been pounding the table predicting recessions and zombie apocalypse for the past 5 years. Are looking a little foolish right now, in my opinion. Now, listen, that's fine if you did your research and that's the independent conclusion you came to, but if you did so just because you follow one doomsday economist who never has anything positive to say, you probably got to start branching out a little bit. You got to broaden your horizons, right? Why? Because one economist is usually not always right. That's just the reality. I mean, economists are people too. They have opinions, they have things, but the reality is that things are virtually impossible to predict with 100% accuracy all the time. Now, one economist who I have been following is someone you might wish to add to your repertoire of people to listen to when it comes to actually, you know, making some opinions about what you think is going to happen. And he's actually considered a mainstream voice in the financial world and one that I consider to be one of the more balanced. His name's Doug Duncan, and he is the chief economist at Fannie Mae. And when we come back, Doug will tell us exactly how he feels about the rest of 2018 and beyond.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. My guest today on Wealth Formula Podcast was named one of Bloomberg and Business Week's 50 most powerful people in real estate. He is Fannie Mae's source for information and analysis on the external business and economic environment, the implications of changes in economic environment to the company's strategy and execution, and forecasting for housing activity, demographics, overall economic activity, and mortgage market activity. Please welcome back Doug Duncan to the show. Doug, how you been?
I'm doing well. Glad to be here. Good to be invited back. That's always the key for an economist is getting invited back.
That's right. So you were on the show almost exactly a year ago. And a lot has happened since then. You know, we got a new president. We were on the brink of nuclear war for a while with North Korea. We got some big tax cuts. How's this economy doing now compared to a year ago?
It's actually doing better. It's picked up some. We actually expect that the second quarter growth, when it's annualized, will look somewhere between 3.5% and 4% growth. So pretty strong expectation for the quarter. That for the year, we expect growth to be a bit higher this year than it was last year. So doing okay.
Yeah. So last time you were on the show, again, mm-hmm. It was almost exactly a year ago. We were sitting there, it was the third longest period in U.S. history without a recession. And it was also the most sluggish, right? Has that component changed, the sluggish aspect? I mean, obviously 3.5%, 4% growth is great, but do you see that as a trend? I mean, how do you see this thing all coming together here?
Well, what we saw in the second half of last year after we had talked was a pickup in business fixed investment, which we interpreted as a result of the reduction in the level of regulation. When the new administration came in, they significantly dropped the issuance of new regulation. And the biggest response that there was in the policy environment was to that, because healthcare reform didn't happen and tax reform didn't happen until almost the very end of the year. But small business in particular, and in particular domestically domiciled companies, saw that drop in regulation issuance as a real positive, and business fixed investment picked up. So we started gaining some steam. Then we had the tax cut. And the tax cut is basically a bet, some of which seems to be paying off, some of which remains to be seen. And the bet goes as follows. If you cut corporate taxes, the hurdle rate for a successful additional investment is now lower. And so you should see a pickup in business investment. That would in turn offer to their employees an improvement in productivity. That improvement in productivity could generate wage gains, which the Fed wouldn't see as inflationary because they were driven by productivity. And then on the consumer side, with the tax cut to most consumers, their returns, their after-tax returns to providing labor go up. And so you should see people come off the sidelines and go to work. We're seeing each of those things, with the exception perhaps of the productivity gains, and that usually lags the investment anyway. The company makes the purchase, they implement the investment, and then it takes a little while to get their workers trained up and to see the improvements in productivity. So it's not surprising we haven't seen that pick up yet, and maybe we won't. We'll see. But that's the nature of the bet. And what has happened is the first quarter this year was better than the first quarter last year. We expect the second quarter this year to be better than the second quarter last year. We expect this to go on into mid to late 2019, when we expect there'll be some slowdown.
Yeah. So help me understand that a little bit better. Help us understand. Because when you look at, you know, I mean, we've been hearing about being at the top of the cycle, so to speak, for a few years now. You know, even I remember even starting this podcast a couple years ago, I was already talking about it then. And of course, some people are laughing about that now. But now we're seeing all of these things that seem to be extending this. Is this, you know, some sort of exception to the rule when it comes to typical market cycles? Or is this just, you know, just a prolonged variation?
Well, in terms of where we are, we're now in the second longest economic expansion that we've ever had. As of August 2019, it will become the longest. Just because it is long doesn't mean it has to end. The statement you'll hear is expansions don't die of old age, they die of a cause. Irrespective of that, they all do end. And given that you're approaching the longest that we've ever had, it seems reasonable to consider what the risks are. Now, one of the counterarguments people give is, well, but it's been one of the weakest expansions. In fact, up until the last year, it was the weakest expansion since World War II. So now you have a couple of stimulative activities. You've had a tax cut. You've had a reduction in the pace of regulation. You've had an increase in spending at the federal level. All of those things would suggest that you would see some extension in the time of this expansion. Of course, working against that, you have the Fed starting to raise interest rates. And eventually, when they raise interest rates, it starts to bite. How are those two things going to come together to create an end to this expansion remains to be seen. But as I mentioned, we do have growth slowing toward the end of 2019, partly because the tax cut and stimulus spends will start to wane in terms of their influence at that time. And the expectation today, according to their own statements, is that the Federal Reserve will be raising interest rates into next year. So all of those things will come together.
Right. When things correct and say it's, you know, mid to late 2019, whenever, I can't count the number of people who have effectively predicted some sort of zombie apocalypse at that point. What do you think, based on where we are in terms of the economy compared to, say, the what may have been the closest we came to a zombie apocalypse in 2008? What do things look like? And when there's a recession, what does that look like? I mean, it used to be that a recession was just part of the cycle, not like when people used to flee for the mountains, right? I mean, so, I mean,
well, so, what I've learned about the whole zombie situation is that in the future, chain link fences don't work. There's not an example, or I would not completely exclude the possibility of a really dramatic downturn, because we had one in the not too distant past. But for example, banks are better capitalized today than they were when that started. You don't have some of the excesses in the mortgage market that you had back then. So the main reason people are worried about the apocalypse is there's no question that the size of our debt is large relative to the economy, and it's increasing. And so it's the sense that at some point that has to be paid back, and that is true. Now, to pay it back, basically a simple way that could happen if Washington chose to get together and put it in place is you simply have to have the economy growing faster than expenses are growing. And over time, then that reduces that debt. And that's what we've done in past periods. Typically, when we fought a war and run up debt for the course of fighting a war. In this instance, I think one of the reasons you get more stories that are apocalyptic is because the run-up in debt is not a function primarily of a global war, there has been some war underway, but it's not been all-encompassing like World War II, for example. And so people are questioning whether the will exists in Washington to get our fiscal situation under control. Our personal view is that more likely than not, there will be a more modest recession when recession comes. And by that, I mean unemployment maybe rising to 7 or 8%, in which case the Fed cuts interest rates. The level of unemployment moving to that level, for example, slows the demand for housing, so the price of house price appreciation or the pace of house price appreciation slows. And for the 92% that are still in the market and the share that want to buy a house, housing may actually provide a cushion for the downside. That's not to say that's the only scenario that you can derive, but I think the recency of the magnitude of downturn that we had militates that the near-term recession, which will come, will be more mild. That said, in the absence of reforming of entitlements, which is where the real budget issue is down the road, the next one could be pretty rough.
And that's that we're talking about, maybe
probably 10 years from now. 12 years down the road, something like that.
Yeah, I've heard actually multiple economists, or sort of mainstream economists, not the zombie kind, but the mainstream ones, talk about this year around 2027 or so with a huge demographic problem. Is that kind of what you're referring to?
It is. And you'll see, I read a piece the other day, and I have not looked up on their website, but you can look on the Social Security Administration's website, and their trustees produce an assessment of the health of the fund, and it becomes payment out of general revenues somewhere around that time frame, if I recall correctly.
Yeah,
and that's actually the easy one of the entitlements to reform. All you have to do is change the eligibility age by a few years and do that over time, not immediately, but over time, and you can extend that fund for some time. That's the simpler one. Medicare and Medicaid are the more complex issues, and they, too, are quickly going to become significant drags on the federal fiscal situation.
So going back to sort of some of the changes in policy with the new administration, I'm curious what what effect do you think on sort of this growing isolationist, not only in the U.S., but really globally, trade policies? I mean, how does that come into this? How do we view that as sort of armchair economists that we're looking at?
Well, one of the phrases I like about economists is if you laid all the economists of the world end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion.
Right.
But one of the things they do reach a conclusion about is that, in general, free trade is beneficial to both parties. So the thing that is that the administration is focused on underneath that, and whether they're right or wrong, is a subject of debate, though not much among economists, is within each of the countries, there are distributional effects for that country, even though in aggregate each country benefits, there are winners and losers within each country, and that's really what the discussion is about. The administration is focused on the losers and suggesting that trade relationships should be adjusted. There's complete consensus among economists that one of the main causes of the Great Depression was the Hawley-Smoot tariffs, which substantially cut global trade and led to a downturn all across the globe. So there's no question there are significant risks being raised in the trade space by the imposition of some of the tariffs. And hopefully those are ultimately more negotiating tactics and tools than they are a significant restriction of trade. And I have to say, my personal view is it's difficult to immediately turn around 40 years of trade liberalization in its entirety.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that there can't be some adjustments. So we have as a risk in our forecast the trade issue because of tariffs that have already been imposed.
Let's talk a little bit more specifically about housing. You kind of talked about it a little bit, but you mentioned the mortgage. You know, the housing market is not the way it was, obviously, back in 2007. So can you give me a sense for, you know, we have a lot of people who invest in single-family homes. We also have a lot of people who invest in multifamily. How do you see the effects of a downturn based on where those markets are right now from an investor standpoint, not necessarily from a homeowner standpoint?
Yeah, if you look at our demographics, depending on the assumptions you make about household formation and immigration in particular, you will see that current production, both of single-family and multifamily properties, is running somewhere between 250 and 400,000 units, less than what current demographics would suggest demand would call for. So that's why you're seeing house prices appreciate at over 6% annually, is because the growth of demand has been more rapid than the growth of supply. That's actually made it a good investment space.
Sure.
Particularly for those folks who bought single families as rentals. They've seen strong rent appreciation and also capital gain appreciation. The production levels at present suggest that will continue for some time. In fact, I know that there are now some builders who are actually building single family detached properties, which are intended to be sold to investors to be rented out to home households. So there's always a real simple metric that suggests why over the long haul real estate's a good place to be, and that is, it's always been the case that people lived in a structure built on land somewhere in proximity to where they worked in a structure built on land. And as long as the population continues to grow and form households, there will be demand for additional space, plus replacement of obsolete or storm-damaged space. So as a general proposition, it's a good place to be. Now, it does vary from region to region, typically highly related to employment, because in order to buy or rent a space, you have to have income. So if employment is growing more rapidly in one geography than in another, you might expect that in general, housing and real estate in general will do better in that place than another. In some cases, you get a circumstance where things have done so well that the performance of real estate actually outpaces the ability of households to afford it.
Yeah.
You think here, some places like San Jose and some other places where there's been very high level of job and income growth in a place where there is a restricted availability of land. And then what you see is the price appreciation outstrips income growth, and you start to see some slowdown. Typically, you also see out-migration of employment from that area so that the companies can afford to pay their workers what's required for them to live somewhere near where they work.
What about how does that affect multifamily? Like say you're an investor in apartment buildings like myself. I kind of look at it, the investment strategy is a little different because now we're focusing on people who really can't buy homes, right? How does that kind of all play to a multifamily investor?
Well, it's still related to employment.
Yeah.
Because the level of employment and income growth related to that employment also impacts the nature of multifamily housing. And typically, Fannie Mae is very involved in multifamily. I think we have around $350 billion of multifamily that we're invested in. Typically, it's classified in A, B, or C level, and that's based on rent price quality. What's happened recently is most of the new production has been in the A or the higher price, higher quality area.
Yep.
And I think you're now going to start to see some migration in some markets of some of those properties getting repriced down into the B space, because the demand growth has really been at the lower end, as the pickup in employment has brought more people off the sidelines.
Yep.
into the workforce, but at the lower spectrum. In that downturn, from a Fannie Mae perspective, you can look at our public financial reports, and you'll see the multifamily part of our business performed well through the entire downturn. And that is because some households lost their homes in foreclosure that had been single family and had to move into rentals. And you also saw the share of the population that grew and was employed typically was renting as house prices were falling. So multifamily did quite well. And from our perspective, it's pretty much back to normal in terms of the current pace of production. So it's been a good asset class to be in.
Yeah. Now, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about from the standpoint of multifamily is that, I think the key in part is not to over leverage at this point, right? Because one of the real danger that it seems like some people, I have some friends in the Arizona market, who had these unusual situations, not necessarily with Fannie Mae loans, but with other agency loans or whatever, but where they were cash flowing fine, but because of the valuation or the cap rate mm-hmm. decompression, they were actually violating their loan covenants and mm-hmm. getting capital calls. Almost to me, mm-hmm. that almost seems like a bigger danger is at that point. I mean, if you have cap rate compression the way it is, do you think that's reasonable?
Yeah, there's a couple things to think about there. One is the multifamily properties are much easier to characterize as an asset class than single family homeowner owned homes. And if you think of the pricing of those assets, using a capital asset pricing model or a discounted cash flow net present value calculation, if the central bank has been holding interest rates extremely low, that's the discount rate. It means the asset values have appreciated. If the discount rate increases, then you'd expect to see some decline in the asset valuation. And I think that's a potential risk. I think there's also the risk that there's a lot of capital around the globe that's looking for a home. And irrespective of other things you might think about the U.S. economy, it's still the best-looking horse outside the blue factory.
That's right.
So it's going to some of that capital is going to come here, and it's going to compete for that for the multifamily space, which has been doing very well over the last decade.
Yeah. So I have another question for you. I'm curious about as a mainstream economist, cryptocurrency is becoming more and more real every day. Distributed ledger technology, certainly in Bitcoin, even though it's taking a beating right now, it looks like a bunch of institutional investors sitting on the sideline, waiting for custodians to, make it possible for them to be able to get in. How, as an economist, are you paying any attention to this right now, to this whole cryptocurrency phenomenon, or is it something that's really not on your radar?
Well, I watch it. It's not affecting my forecast today, but there's a two or three reasons why I pay some attention to it. I certainly wouldn't characterize myself as an expert. First, there's a difference between the cryptocurrency and the base technology that allows it, the distributed ledger technology.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That whether cryptocurrency becomes a thing, I think in significant part depends on how governments react to it. And one of the libertarian impulses behind the cryptocurrency is if you could create a currency which the government can't affect, then the Fed, for example, couldn't be reducing the value of your currency by 2% annually, which is their stated target.
Yeah,
I get that, and I happen to agree that 0% is the best rate of inflation. The distributed ledger technology underlying that, I think there's a lot of hopes and a lot of experimentation taking place in that, which its main driver is to reduce the size of the middleman and therefore make things more efficient economically.
Yep.
That one, I think, is fairly interesting, and I think eventually will find its way into improving processes in various industries. So if I was a middleman in something, I would be given some thought to how that might play out.
Yeah, right, right. Like a bank.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Fannie Mae.
Yeah, right, know? Right.
So,
yeah. So you're going to tokenize Fannie Mae?
Well, not too long ago at some event, I was introduced as the extinguished economist from Fannie Mae. So I'm hoping not to fulfill that expectation.
That's funny. And in terms of Bitcoin right now, though, you don't see it as something that's really has an impact in the mainstream economy per se. Bitcoin as a currency or a... So,
not yet. It's too volatile. It's really more people, I think, are looking at it as an asset, and the appreciation or depreciation of it is what's driving, as opposed to a store of value, which is constant, which I think is what a lot of people are really thinking about.
Now, not asking you to give investment advice here by any means, but I'm curious. When you think of where we're at right now with the idea that what you were saying about the economy probably continuing to grow for, another year, likely, Ray Dalio's come out and said the same thing about, the next couple of years, if you're sort of on the sidelines, you might feel a little foolish. And then you've got, sort of the inevitability of a downturn. Maybe it's not as big. And then you've got this thing that people have been talking about now, but in 2027 around that area, which may be truly the zombie apocalypse or the next Great Depression. How are you looking at this from a personal investing perspective, just for yourself? So, I mean, we won't consider it advice because we know we don't do that here on the show, but how do you see it just to kind of get in the mind of an economist?
Well, you can look at all the research literature, and the research literature will tell you that it's extremely difficult to time the market. So if you're it's kind of like I tell people who call me, I'll from time to time get just average consumer will call and say, "Is this a good time to buy a house?"
Yeah.
And I'll ask them, "Have you got a household budget?" That's the first thing, and then second is if you do. And according to today's house prices and interest rates, it fits your budget, then go ahead and make the move. Because if you're waiting for interest rates or house prices to fall, now you've moved from being a home buyer to being a speculator. And
right.
Can you afford to be a speculator?
Right.
So from a market timing perspective, that's a speculative kind of decision. So if it fits your objectives, then you should move to align your investments to your risk appetite. If you miss out at the very top, say you miss the top 10%, well, you may also miss the 40% decline because you made that move, right?
Right.
And a lot of people don't do the second part of the calculation and say, well, if I, after it's revealed, maybe I missed 15 or 20% of upside, but I also didn't take 30% of downside.
Right.
And I'm of the view that cash is opportunistic in a downturn, and you can buy assets on the cheap in a downturn, which makes up for having missed some of that upside, if that's the if that fits your risk profile.
Right.
But
right.
You kind of have to understand your own risk profile and where you are in life and what kind of things you can tolerate. And if you're 30, you probably have a different profile than if you're 60.
Right.
So you kind of have to adjust for those things.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. I like the sufficiently ambiguous answer there.
It really is the individual in two ways.
Right,
you
right.
know your household and
right.
You also know your risk and tolerance. I probably have a little higher risk tolerance than some others.
But. Yeah, absolutely. Well, great. This has been fantastic, Doug. And, thank you very much for being on. Tell us a little bit about where... You know, if you're interested in this stuff and trying to follow what your thoughts are on, what's going on with the economy, can you give us an idea where we might be able to get some of that information?
Yeah, we have a segment on our website, fanniemae.com, there's a section on economics and research. And we have lots of stuff up there from our forecasts to all kinds of special topic research that we do. Most of it tailored toward housing or characteristics of the economy that generate activity in housing, but not all of it. It's all free, so it's just a matter of going in there. And if folks can't find it, they could just shoot a message to me or one of my staff, and we'll help them find it.
Fantastic. Thanks. Thanks for being on the show again, and hopefully we'll do the hat trick in maybe another year and find out. We'll go back and listen to some of these thoughts and compare them to where we're at.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Doug is always a great guy to talk to. I mean, he's just a really good guy, and he's a great voice of reason, in my opinion. As an investor, I think in times like these, we just need to make sure, in my opinion, again, that we're investing in quality assets. And I think Doug echoes that, right? You can't really time these markets. And sometimes you just have to make smart investments and know that, they may be ups and downs. But, if you don't invest at all, I mean, you may miss out. For example, I will tell you that the only kind of real estate that I'm touching right now is where there's a really deep value add component. If you're in my accredited investor group, you're seeing exactly what I mean by that, by the types of things that we're getting involved with. By the way, I should point out, if you are an accredited investor, that you should definitely sign up for Investor Club at wealthformula.com. Now, why do I say deep value add? Well, listen, if even though cap rates are compressed, I don't think that people are going to argue against that. The cap rates are compressed right now. We can still drive net operating income up. And if we can do that, we can still effectively decompress the cost of buying that asset. I don't think it's a good time to buy things and simply hold them. I don't think that the yield is there to do that. And I think I've seen situations where people have potentially gotten themselves in trouble. And I also personally believe that middle markets are not a great idea right now. I know of people who have invested, for example, in Oklahoma City that probably shouldn't have done that. It's not a primary market. They're already, they're not thriving, but on the other hand, I think they're just a recession away from losing their properties. So quality assets in primary markets with a value add business plan. That's my focus. I don't usually just lay it out there, but that's really my focus. Of course, I'm also hedging with life settlements, with some cash, and as always, having a little speculative play in cryptocurrency and in the junior mining markets as well. But again, that is not investment advice. Do your own research. Read up more on Doug's research and follow some other economists as well. And if you have a favorite, send me that name at buck@wealthformula.com and tell me who you follow and why. Because no one person gets it all right, and it's a good idea to follow and listen to many. Now, one last thing. If you like the show and you want to show your love, make sure to go to wealthformula.com and give us a five-star review, a five-star rating and review. Why? Because this matters a lot. It matters because that's the way iTunes and Apple rank their shows, etc. And that's how we pick up more listeners. That's how we continue to get great guests like Doug Duncan. And again, don't forget, download the Wealth Formula app. That's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.